Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emmanuel, we teach Messianic Judaism for all nations. If you find these teachings helpful, please share them with your friends and family. Help us advance the teachings of the kingdom, and remember to support Beth Emmanuel with your prayers and financial gifts.
Very quickly over Hebrews chapter 11. If you're looking for those teachings a little bit more on Hebrews chapter 11, you can find them online under the title, The Book of Faith and Hope. But today we're going to finish up with that and push into Hebrews chapter 12. But first I want to we're just going to start at the top of 11, chapter 11, verse 2. Just have a few things to say, a few things to wrap up here. Actually feels appropriate after Sarah's presentation to speak about these things. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 2, it says, "For by faith the people of old received their commendation." All right, the people of old being these series of witnesses who clung steadfastly to the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen, men and women of faith, the Bible heroes. It says, "For by faith the people of old," these are the people of old, "received their commendation." What's a commendation? A better translation would be, "For by faith the people of old received their witness." They received their witness, or if you prefer, they received their testimony. They were testified of, they were witnessed. The Greek word behind witness, of course, is martyrial. Martyrial, which is, interestingly, that's where we get the word martyr from. English word, martyr, martyrial, Greek, martyr, English. It's one of those funny words that has had a shift in its semantic value. Martyr didn't originally mean martyr, it originally meant witness. Like a witness who testifies in a court of law, "I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth." And the meaning of the word began to shift then in the Roman era when Roman tribunals convened and to try people who were suspected of adhering to the illegal Jewish superstition of the Christians. So if you're suspected of being one of these Christians, you might find yourself standing before a tribunal on trial in public before somebody like Pontius Pilate, and these tribunals would force you to renounce your allegiance publicly, to renounce your allegiance to Christ, and then to prove your renouncing by publicly blaspheming his name, and then, just to be sure, the icing on the cake, quickly worship this idol of Caesar. That's how the tribunals worked. And they would ask him, "Are you a follower of Christus? Are you a follower of this one who's called Christ?" And that's when the believer, at that point, that's when you're put on the spot, that's when you testified. "I swear, solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth." That's when you witnessed. That's when you became a witness, a martyr. So when a believer stood up and made his testimony by refusing to renounce the name of Messiah, he was called a martyrio, a witness, and he was called this by the community of believers. And then what happened was the tribunal would sentence this believer to death. So the witnesses became the victims of Rome, and that's how the meaning of the word shifted from witness to the way we use it today, which means, a martyr is someone who sacrifices his life for his religious convictions. So I cringe when I hear people refer to suicide bombers, Islamic suicide bombers, as martyrs. I mean, actually, it does fit. They certainly choose to die for their convictions, but that's a long way removed from the original meaning of the word, as one who testifies in a court. Anyway, these Roman prosecutions that I'm talking about, persecutions, they hadn't begun that hadn't happened yet when the book of Hebrews was written. But something similar was already afoot. Instead of the Romans, the Sadducees, the Sadducean priesthood that held religious authority in Judea, were conducting similar trials among Jewish believers, forcing people to publicly renounce their allegiance to Yeshua. It happened to James, the brother of the master. As you know, they arrested him, stood him up on the parapet of the temple and told him to publicly renounce his faith at Passover in front of the people, in front of all the pilgrims that were coming up to the temple. And they said, "Now you're going to tell these people straight, because they think he's the Messiah." And so they say, "Hey, James, what do you know about this Yeshua guy?" James is up there and he says, "Why are you asking me about the Son of David? Who's quickly coming?" And all the pilgrims said, "Hosanna!" And then they pushed him off. And he died for his witness. So the writer of the book of Hebrews is encouraging his readership to be witnesses, like James, to hold on to their testimony for the Messiah despite the pressure and persecution that they're under, the pressure to renounce their faith. And he points to men and women of faith in the past as biblical examples, people of old, the people of faith, these biblical heroes that received their testimony, their faith testified about them. They are witnesses. Now, witnesses. I grew up, as you know, I always like to point out, I grew up evangelical, so I see everything through an evangelical sort of like, I have to like, first thing is like, I mean, you never leave your mother religion. You know, it's like, that's your first paradigm, always. Anyway, so everything's witnessing. I know witnessing. I've been, you know, I grew up witnessing. In evangelicalism, witnessing means, you know, sharing the gospel and persuading men to believe what we believe, which, you know, there's another English word for that. It's called proselytizing. Witnessing, proselytizing, same thing. Go out into the world and attempting to, you know, proselytize people. Like Sarah, you're just going to go to India and try to proselytize people. You know, this is what we do. This is our faith. We spread the good news. We spread the gospel. Yeshua sends out apostles. He says, I'm appointing you to be witnesses of my resurrection to the whole world. In Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So, you know, that's my perspective as well as an evangelical. I mean, sometimes we would go, it gets a little crazy. We'd like send out, I was never part of this, but I knew of people who were, would send out a team like to the mall. You go to the mall with tracts behind your back, right? I never did this, but I knew people who did. You go to them, and then you would accost these hapless passerby, you know, like as if you were trying to, I don't know, it was like a political campaign or something, or like you're like Moonies at the air. Does anybody remember the Moonies? One good thing that happened after 9/11 was the Moonies can't get into the airport anymore, right? To sell you the flowers. It was like that, as if it was, you know, this sort of like cheapening of the faith, you know, that we're going to go out and sell it like a product. That's not witnessing. I mean, that's not what we had in mind here in Hebrews 11 anyway. You know, I had in mind holding on to your testimony, standing firm for your testimony. Yeshua, he commissions his apostles to testify about his resurrection. They should go before all men. And when they're in the situation, they have the opportunity. They're going to testify on his behalf, in his name. And, you know, that's the apostolic mission that's been bequeathed to us. And we stand for the testimony, not just of Yeshua, that there was a guy from Nazareth, but he rose. You know, he's alive. He's alive today. He's seated at the right hand, even today. And he's coming again. That's what we stand for. That's our witness. That's our, like we learned last week, our anima amin. I believe. With a complete faith in the coming of the Messiah, though he may tarry, right? So, here's the thing. If Caiaphas and the Sadducees corner you and try to force you to renounce your faith in the resurrection of Yeshua, what are you going to do? Well, you're not going to. You're going to refuse. You know, why would they want you to renounce your faith? They don't believe in the resurrection. That's what's irritating them in the first place about you going around and saying you believe in a guy who came back from the dead. They don't believe in people coming back from the dead. So they're going to try to... Now, don't worry about it. They've not been around for a long time. It's not going to happen. But if it was, you would know what to do. You'd say, throw me in jail, throw me in prison, do your worst, whatever. Throw me off the top of the temple. I'm not backing down. He's alive. Right? Or if the Herodians, for example, King Agrippa, arrests you and tries to force you to renounce your allegiance to King Messiah as the rightful king and the son of David... What are you going to do in this situation? Because he's going to say, hey, I'm the king of the Jews now. You understand? You got to let this thing go. Let this thing go. The house of David's done. It's the Hasmonean house now, right? That's what Agrippa's going to do. You're going to take your stand. Like James, the brother of John, James, the son of Zebedee. You're going to take your stand. You're going to say, yeah, but my allegiance is with the son of David, with King Yeshua. Yeshua of Nazareth. And then he's going to, and you're going to say, go ahead, cut my head off, because that's what happened to James. He took a stand. He was a witness. Or if the Romans try to force you to renounce your allegiance, you know, the Romans, they say, hey, you're part of this superstition. Are you part of this illegal superstition that Caesar, and you know, you're not worshiping our gods anymore? What are you going to do? Well, you're going to testify at that time. You're going to say, yes, I am a believer. And no, I won't worship your gods, and I won't worship the Caesar. You know, and you pay for this. You're going to pay for this with your life. That's what the apostles had in mind, that kind of thing. This is what they had in mind when they spoke of being a witness, of having a testimony of faith. It's less awkward, actually, than canvassing a mall with a handful of tracts. It's maybe a little less awkward. But in our day and age, of course, we're not dealing with Sadducees, are we? There's no Sadducees, Herodians, Romans. Instead, it's even worse than that. There are totalitarian atheist regimes putting us to death, Muslim fundamentalists putting us to death, secular authorities from fascist governments putting us to death. You know, you're saying, wait a second, you know, Obama is bad, but he's not that bad. No, there's a whole world here I'm talking about. You know, there have been more martyrs in the last century for the name of Messiah than in any century since he came. That's true. You know, thank God we don't deal with that type of persecution here. We don't have to witness in that way. We don't witness by laying down our lives in this country, right? Not yet. Okay. Instead, the adversary plays a far more subtle game in the West, doesn't he? His pressure is no less intense, though. He uses other tactics to silence our testimony. He has powerful weapons in his arsenal, such as embarrassment. Oh, jeez. Social pressure. Moral relativism. Who says it's true? It's not true. Materialism. Bling. Sensuality. Self-indulgence, far more powerful than a guy with a gun. The world tries to force you to renounce Yeshua by conforming to its standards. The world says, you know what? Whatever you believe is good with you, as long as you don't bother anyone else with it, as long as you don't judge us. And the world says, it doesn't matter what you believe so long as you conform to our immoral values and behave as we do. The world tempts the believer to be just like everybody else, that's the thing. Just like everybody else, by accepting the social norms, but a real witness for Messiah is not like everybody else. The life of a true disciple is markedly different than the rest of the world. It should stick out. You want to be a witness. You know, you want to be a witness for Messiah. Try being a single person in this culture who lives by biblical standards of monogamous fidelity reserved for marriage, and that's a male and female marriage. That's a testimony. And the world will laugh at you for it. That's true. And throw every possible temptation to derail you. Or you want to be a witness for the Messiah. Try keeping the Sabbath. Try keeping the Sabbath day. Try keeping a holy day. Try keeping anything holy. The world will do everything possible to break you of that habit. I'm just saying, you know, we might not be chased by Sadducees and Romans. We're not necessarily fleeing from the Chinese government or the Muslim Brotherhood here. But we have our own problems, don't we? We have our own struggles to maintain our testimony. So he gives us these examples, these heroes. He gives us these examples from the Bible, these men and women of faith whose faith testified of them. So Abel, for example. Take Abel, for example. Abel obtained a testimony, he says, that he was righteous. God testified about his gifts, receiving his sacrifice, right? And what happened to him? Well, he got killed for that. He suffered and he died for his testimony. Enoch obtained the testimony. God took him up, and so on and so forth. And he goes through this list of biblical heroes, concluding with the stories of the prophets. Like in verse 36, he says, others suffered mocking, now we're into the prophets, and flogging, and chains, and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. I mentioned that's Isaiah. That's specifically Isaiah right there. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And then he says, and all these, though commended through their faith, witnessed through their faith, testified is the word, through their faith, they did not receive what was promised. They did not receive what was promised. They were holding on to the promises and the hope of the kingdom. They were holding on to the promise and the hope of the coming of the Messiah, the redemption, the reward of the righteous. The righteous will be rewarded and the wicked will be punished. And they're holding on to the idea of the kingdom of heaven on earth. And they died for their assurance of that hope and their conviction, unrewarded. Unseen future is all that they had. They lived for something and died for something and did not receive it. That's his point. It says, though they witnessed through their faith and their faith testified of them, they didn't receive the promise. Why? Well, he says, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. He means they did not receive what was promised because they did not live to see the coming of the Messiah like his generation had. And they did not live to receive the final redemption like his generation was about to, or so he supposed. If they had received what was promised, they would have already entered into the kingdom of the resurrection. That's what made perfect means. So if they had received it, they would have received it without us receiving it. They would have received it. There wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't be here. So in other words, they suffered and they bled and they died for their faith without receiving the reward so that we could also share with them, along with them in Messiah, in the kingdom, in the resurrection, in the world to come. The generation to whom this epistle that we're studying was originally addressed had already seen these promises being fulfilled. Blessed are your eyes because they see. Blessed are your ears because they hear. For many prophets and righteous men long to see what you see but did not see, and to hear what you hear but did not hear it. They had already seen the person of Yeshua, his resurrection, and now they stood on the threshold of the final redemption. It was at the door. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. They were about to be made perfect, and when the perfect comes, here's what he's saying. Then the heroes of the faith will rise again, and they will be made perfect along with the readers of the epistle. And we're still waiting, along with us. And that's how I understand it. And that explains the next statement. Top of chapter 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. You've heard this verse before? Therefore, since we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, what does it mean we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses? I mean, sometimes, at least this is how I've heard it. Maybe you've never heard this before. I've heard this verse is used to indicate that the saints are watching. You know, look out, because the saints are watching. They're watching our lives. It's like, it's like Big Brother. It's like 1984. It's like a movie. It's like reality TV. You know, they're all up there in heaven watching our lives. It's embarrassing, for crying out loud. You know, it's like, come on, give me a little privacy here. You know, so you better lay your sin aside, because here's the prophets and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they're eating popcorn and watching your life. You know, it's like that movie, you know, I see dead people. You know, this is like dead people see me. You know. That's not exactly how I understand it. First of all, I don't think the writer of the book of Hebrews would try to compel us to righteous living on the basis that biblical heroes are watching our lives, because that interpretation ignores the obvious, weightier motivation for obedience that Hashem is watching our lives. You know, the Bible calls upon us to live according to the fear of the Lord, not the fear of men, much less dead men. Second, as we've seen, they are called witnesses because they remained faithful to the promises. They are called witnesses because of their faith, not because they are witnesses of us, not because they're witnessing us. Their faith is testified about them, and they testify by their faith. Okay, despite that, I still think, you know, the basic imagery of like, you can imagine a stadium or something like this, or a gymnasium, a circus, a racetrack, you know, a Roman racetrack, common in the Roman world. This is an idea here that the believer, you as the disciple, are a runner in a race. You're in the Olympics. You're at the starting line, and the stands are filled with spectators. But unlike unlike normal spectators, these are all professional athletes who have run this race themselves and already completed this race. And it's not, the point is not that they're watching you, scrutinizing you. The point is that their testimony should hold you accountable. Because as you're preparing at the starting line of this race, and you look up into the stands and into the seats, and you see Abraham's life and how he passed his many tests of faith, including the sacrifice of his son, Isaac. And you see Isaac and you see his life and what he endured and held on to the promises. And you see Jacob and what he endured and how he endured exile twice. And Joseph, how he was mistreated. He was mistreated by the people, you know, he trusted. He was betrayed. And yet he endured. You know, you see these lives. And here's Moses' life, the life of Moses. It's not that they're watching you. It's that you're watching them. You see them. You see Joshua and the judges and the prophets. And you see their lives and the story of their faith. And it's surrounding you, this great cloud of witnesses that have testified, surrounds you, and now it's your turn. So don't blow it. He says, therefore, because this is the situation, let's lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. I like this. Lay aside every weight and sin. I mean, imagine you're watching this epic race. It's a sprint. It's the Olympics. And the guy for the American team, starting at, you know, he's waiting for the gun to go off with the other runners. And suddenly you realize, wait a second, this guy has like lead weights strapped to his body. You know, it's like a penalty or, you know, a handicap or something. And the gun fires. All the sprinters take off. Your guy is dragging, you know. He's like got big lead weights strapped to his body. That's kind of the image here. If you're going to run this race, you don't want to be weighted down. And what's weighting you down? A sin which clings so closely. It says, lay this aside and run with endurance. It says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, you know, the finish line, he saw the kingdom ahead. This was the joy that was set before him, was the kingdom, the redemption. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. And in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood, have you? So we're in this race of faith, and many have run this race of faith before us. And yeah, we know it's a struggle to maintain our testimony of faith, especially with Sadducees lurking around and whatnot. It's a difficult race, and it's possible to fail, and it's possible to not finish the race, and we see it happen to other runners all the time. They drop out of the race. We see people just drop out of the race. Some are exhausted, some collapse, some just go the wrong direction, you know. Just running in the wrong direction. Some grow faint-hearted. Some lose the struggle. Some lose their witness. You lose your witness. You lose your testimony. You can lose it by succumbing to the pressure of the world and renouncing Yeshua. And we can lose our testimony by falling prey to the sin which so easily entangles, the temptation, giving up on righteousness, giving up on Torah, giving up on a biblical life, and stumble in this race. Have that stumbling blocks. That's why they're called stumbling blocks, because you stumble over them. Stumble. And, you know, if you're burdened by that weight of sin, it's hard to run. It clings to us. And that sounds, well, this is starting to sound very discouraging. Kind of a depressing note to end this sermon on, don't you think? It's supposed to be a word of exhortation, an encouragement, not a discouragement, but it is an encouragement. The point is, he says, keep your eyes on Yeshua. He uses these beautiful words. This is the founder. But he doesn't say just the founder of our faith. The founder of our faith, for sure, we know. And he says the founder and the perfecter of our faith. It's not that you must have perfect faith. You're never going to be Abraham. You're never going to be, woman of perfect, flawless faith who never stumbles and never gets entangled in a sin and never fails. None of us have perfect faith. All of us struggle. But we have a perfecter of our imperfect faith if we keep our eyes upon him. He will not let us stumble. He will bring us across the finish line. So here's the message. Don't give up. You're not alone. You are not the first to run this mile. Others have run this race before you. A great cloud of witnesses, in fact, and they've all crossed the finish line. It can be done. So remember the testimony of these witnesses and all that they sacrificed and all that they endured for this faith. And keep your eyes on Yeshua, the founder and the perfecter of our faith, who ran the race for joy, for the sake of joy.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.